Okay, I'm Edner Sessian, director of the center. I will just tell you our next two programs, and then Dr. Hurwitz, who is the associate director, will introduce the participants, and then we get going. So our next roundtable, organized by the gentleman sitting there, will be on meditation. And the one after that will be on neurodiversity. So one will be on April 19th, and the other one would be on May 10th. We may have a third one in June, but right now I'm working on it. Jerry?
Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. Welcome. I'm going to quickly read through these bios, which are extensive, and I invite you to look at them online. There are more complete bios there. As I mention your name, please raise your hand so the audience knows who I'm speaking about. Joseph Ledoux is a professor of neural science at New York University. His work, which has spanned the topics of emotion, memory, and consciousness, and their interaction in the brain. He is an elected member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He has received numerous awards for his work and is the author of several acclaimed books, including The Emotional Brain, Synaptic Self, Anxious, The Deep History of Ourselves, and The Four Realms of Existence. He is also a lead singer and a songwriter in the rock band The Amygdaloids. His music has been the subject of a play, Map of Your Mind, and was featured in Werner Herzog's 2024 film, Theater of Thought. A documentary on Amazon, Neuroscience and Emotions, explores his work, his life, work, and music. Joanne Lowy is the director of the Department of Music Therapy and a professor at Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She is a founding member of the International Association for Music and Medicine and is one of the principal investigators on two NIH-funded studies on pain and music therapy in the stress measured by metabolic pathways of Black pregnant women. In addition to serving as editor-in-chief of the international peer-reviewed journal Music and Medicine, her clinical work has been featured in the New York Times and in research in numerous medical journals. Now, for some reason, the letters get smaller here, so bear with me. Jane Ira Bloom is a pioneering soprano saxophonist and composer with over 45 years of experience, renowned for her innovative use of live electronics and movement in jazz. She has received numerous accolades, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Downbeat International Critics Poll, the Jazz Journalists Association Award, the Mary Lou Williams Award for Lifetime Service to Jazz, and the Charlie Parker Fellowship for Jazz Innovation. Bloom was the first musician commissioned by the NASA Art Program, and get this, has an asteroid named after her. Yeah. 6083 Jane Ira Bloom, in case you're looking it up. Her trio album, Early Americans, won a Grammy Award for Best Surround Sound Album, while her recent duo recording, Picturing the Invisible, inspired by Berenice Abbott's photography, earned a Grammy nomination for Best Immersive Audio. Bloom has recorded 30 albums since 1977 and will release her latest immersive project, Songs in Space, this year, featuring Bobby Previtt, Mark Helias, and Dominic Falacaro. Roseanne Cash is one of the most ambitious and literary songwriters of her generation, according to Rolling Stone, known for her poignant vocals and incisive storytelling. A four-time Grammy winner with 12 additional nominations, she received three Grammys for The River and The Thread in 2014 and became the first woman to win the Edward McDowell Award for Music Composition in 2021. Her 2010 memoir, Composed, was praised by the Chicago Tribune as one of the best accounts of an American life you'll likely ever read. In 2023, Cash was elected as honorary American member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. In 2023, Cash and her husband, John Leventhal, a six-time Grammy winner and producer and songwriter, launched Rumble Strip Records to reissue Cash's early Columbia Sony work. Lydia Gore is Fred and Fanny Mack Professor of Humanities in the Department of Philosophy at Columbia University. She is the author of The Imaginary Museum of Musical Works, an essay in the philosophy of music, The Quest for Voice, Music, Politics, and the Limits of Philosophy, Elective Affinities, Musical Essays on the History of Aesthetic Theory, Red Sea, Red Square, Red Thread, a Philosophical Detective Story. And finally, joining us remotely is Dr. David Silberzweig. He is a neurologist and psychiatrist known for pioneering functional neuroimaging research in psychiatry. A Dartmouth graduate in philosophy, he earned his medical degree from Cornell University Medical College and trained in both psychiatry and neurology at Cornell. He completed his research training in functional brain imaging at the Medical Research Council Cyclotron Unit in London before returning to Cornell, where he co-founded the Functional Neuroimaging Laboratory with Dr. Emily Stern and became the founding director of both the Division of Neuropsychiatry and the Neurology Psychiatry Combined Residency Program. Dr. Silberzweig was later recruited to Harvard, where he served as chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital, chairman of Brigham and Women's Hospital Institute for the Neurosciences, and co-director of the Center for the Neurosciences. Okay, I think that's quite a lot to absorb. Anyway, with that, we'll get started with Music in Mind.
Anybody can start.
I think the person who has an asteroid named after her should start.
Second.
Right. All right. I'm gonna throw something out, and I'm sure from various points of view you can address this. Because I was thinking about it a little bit. The difference. I'm a practitioner. You know, I'm a composer and a saxophone and music maker. But something that happens to musicians when they study instrumental music, and musicians when they are singer-songwriters and deal in the world of words. In my world, I often run into students who are studying instrumental music, but when they hear a song with words, they don't admit to this, but they do not hear the meaning. They're just hearing tones. I actually can relate to this because when I was younger, this was my experience too. And it was only much later in my life that I learned to listen to the meaning of the words. Something else was going on in my music education or something. Interesting story about a student I had who had a girlfriend he was talking to, and there was this rap song he was listening to, and he was like crazy about this rap song. And then his girlfriend comes out and he said, "What are you doing? You know, listen to that thing. Aren't you listening to the misogynistic lyrics that are going on in this thing?" And he didn't even hear them. So I just thought I'd throw this out here. I'm sitting next to someone who lives in the world of premier poetry in song, and a completely different relationship to words and tone. And anyway, let's throw it around. Words and music.
Yeah, as a lyricist, that troubles me. Because the kind of environment I grew up in as a songwriter and the mentors I had, they were ruthless as lyricists, and every syllable had to count. And I had a mentor who said, the best line of your song doesn't serve the rest of your song, you have to throw it out. Lyrics, I always resented the idea of music where lyrics were just to fill in the blanks of a melody or a beat. Or that songwriting wasn't real writing. You know, that it was just something to fit into a backbeat. So that's a different world than I come from. I can understand it, but I kind of resent it.
So when you write a song, do you how often do you start with the lyrics versus the chords?
Me, most of the time. Most of the time. But mainly because I'm co-writing right now and he writes, he doesn't write lyrics. So he writes the music. What about you?
I find that it swings kind of both ways. So if sometimes I just start strumming the guitar and hope something comes out. Other times, you know, because I created this crazy genre called heavy mental music about mind and brain, which is related to my work. I had an endless supply of songs or ideas that you take from some aspect. For example, theory of mind is very big in psychology. So the album that you sang backups on for one of my songs, the lead song in that song in that album was "Do You Have a Theory of My Mind?" So the idea is that, you know, in a relationship, you have to get into the other person's mind. And as the song went, if you have a theory of my mind, why do you treat me so bad? And, you know, on and on. So most of these songs have been kind of love songs about mind and brain and mental disorders, but probably most rock songs are about mind and brain and mental disorders.
And hookups and breakup.
Start with words, let's say, is it the meter or the meaning of the word? But that's also...
So I know someone who says, write everything, edit later. So sometimes it's images, overheard bits of conversation, unformed feeling, and then a meter comes in after that. But I was thinking about, you know, I had brain surgery, which is really what qualifies me to be here.
I hope Judy can do it.
But when I was recovering, I couldn't bear to listen to lyrics. I could only listen to music without lyrics. It was so confusing, you know. So there is a space for Samuel Barber.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sorry, please.
Well, I come from a different field in many ways. I come from the field of classical music. I'm a violinist by background and training. And one of the things that occurs in my field of the philosophy of music is in the history of 19th century song or in 19th century opera, or the whole history of opera, it was mostly the case that in performances, people would listen to the opera in a foreign language. And it was only when subtitles came in the opera halls that people actually knew what was going on in the plot. I remember seeing a Wagner opera at the Met, the Meistersinger, and suddenly there was a joke, in many jokes in the text, but there was one joke and the audience laughed and the singer stopped. He was a German singer, Hermann Prey, and he actually stopped in the middle because he'd never heard an American audience react to his piece of comedy before because they'd never understood. So I was actually brought up in a background, well, all my family are musicians, but I was... But I was brought up in a context where the words were there as supplementary to the music, always secondary. And it's only with modern technologies that you actually know what's going on. But I was going to say something about your people who have Alzheimer's. My partner is an opera singer. It's really annoying. I can't be speaking such vibrant words.
May I say something?
I just wanted to finish one sentence, if I may. My partner, who's a former opera singer and has Alzheimer's now, he also finds lyrics very distressing. He used to speak seven languages, had 90 libretti in his head, and now he finds the lyrics upset his musical memory, and he can remember the songs, but not the words. It's really interesting, and it maybe relates to that experience. So.
Yeah, so in this context, I'm a jazz trombone player and a drummer, but my day job is the sort of stuff that you heard about, and it is great to see Joe, and with whom I had the privilege of working for a number of years, and my greatly respect for his neuroscience and of course his music. What we're talking about really. Coming back to your original point, Jane, and some of the points that have been made in the interim, is from the point of view of the brain, an issue, a number, it brings up a number of issues that are really interesting. One is just attention and how we allocate attention to one thing or another, whether that is a different modality, like words, or the tonality and the music. And while both hemispheres of the brain are involved with both for sure, and it's an oversimplification, language is more involved in the dominant hemisphere, and music is more processed in the non-dominant hemisphere, although a lot of analytic and temporal processing, because it's sound over time, has to take place in the dominant hemisphere. And so there's the issue of allocation of attention when you were saying that people pay attention to one or the other, at least the person you described, and also perhaps of plasticity. When we learn an instrument or we engage in a certain kind of music, those neurons in those areas of the brain that represent the frequencies and tonalities of the music or that one is primarily engaged in become more connected to one another, and their processing is enhanced, and so that may be playing a role in addition to modulation of attention. And then another is competition for resources, sort of computing resources in the brain, at the same time for both music, for both lyrics and music. Although many of us grow up and process both quite beautifully at the same time. With regard to Alzheimer's disease, it's interesting you described that your partner found it distressing, although part of it was the interference with memories or, multiple languages. And as people develop a Alzheimer's disease, or with certain kinds of stroke in the language areas, they sort of resort to their primary languages, and the languages that they've learned subsequently or which they're not as comfortable in sort of go by the wayside. And so there may be some difficulty that he's having there. A lot of people with Alzheimer's respond beautifully to music and music therapy, as I'm sure Joanne can tell us, and they can even lose language in their dominant hemisphere, but they can sing "Happy Birthday" because the memories that of those simple and old tunes can really activate and co-activate with their emotional and motivational systems in a way that can be both activating as well as calming. So there are a lot of fascinating things about the brain, both in terms of normal, healthy processing and when different diseases strike, and the sorts of things that you all were describing, I think are illustrative of some of them.
May I
just point blank, I think we have to distinguish between words, just as words, and lyrics. Suzanne Lenker talked about the difference between putting melody to words, then in a song it becomes lyrics. But we learn melodies way before we learn words. From the moment we're born, cry and comfort sounds are expressions of either soothing or distress. And then if you look at language development, we have different stages we go through of phonemes and morphemes. And I think it is important, you're quite right, to look at how people who can't speak We run a stroke choir where people can barely walk or make words, and they're singing with their caregivers songs from their past. There's a music brain, and as like a phenotype in the brain in Alzheimer's too, melodies have been imprinted in the neural pathway.
So that, I mean, we're talking about different kinds of memory. So like implicit memories, like remembering maybe some lyrics or something, but also memory of how to play an instrument. My mother, for example, I grew up in a Cajun family in Louisiana, and she played accordion, French accordion. So when she got really severe Alzheimer's, of course, the explicit memories, like her knowledge of who she was and who I was and so forth, were all gone, but she could pick up the accordion and still play the Mi Fe Do Do song. So that's it's important to keep those kinds of things separated, explicit and implicit. But David, right. You know, we worked together for 10 years and we never did get to play music together.
Mm-hmm. I know, but we went to an Eric Clapton concert together. So that was great.
Just wanted, I have a counterexample. My mother had a major stroke and she lost the capacity to speak English, which was her first language. But when she was 16 years old, she had learned the rudiments of Hebrew because she intended to go to Israel just after the Second World War. And she hadn't spoken Hebrew her whole life. She was now 89 years old. She couldn't speak English, but she started writing with one hand she had left in Hebrew. Backwards. Yeah. So her second language came back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she had second language and opera songs in her head. That was the last thing she had. But is that, have you heard?
Yeah, that can happen. And, you know, with.
And language remains.
Yeah. The in strokes, depending upon exactly where in the language system, there have been brain imaging experiments that have shown that first and second languages, for instance, occupy similar but distinct, nearby but distinct regions of some of these auditory, linguistic, and musical pathways. And in the case of language, you can knock out either one depending upon which particular subregion of the temporoparietal cortex, for instance, that goes out with the stroke. And to Joe's point about implicit versus procedural memory, which is very important, it's also the issue of what becomes automatic versus having to pay conscious attention to it. And so when one is first learning an instrument, you have to pay attention and it's effortful and it's conscious. But then it gets, and your frontal cortex is engaged and other regions. But as it becomes automatized, it gets subcorticalized into areas that include the basal ganglia, some of these more primal automatic areas of the brain. And that's why a professional musician or someone who's very skilled doesn't even have to think about exactly where they're putting their fingers or whatever. And then they can start to create art because they've subcorticalized or automatized the playing of the instrument, for instance, but then can use their creativity. And there's a whole other issue about where or how creativity is in the brain. But they can use other regions of the brain that are then freed up to express themselves with those more automated algorithms, if you will.
I hate to add one more anecdote, but maybe I don't hate to. But the most moving experience I ever had in performance was a couple of years ago, my friend Chris Christopherson, who some of you know who he is, he had severe dementia, but he could still remember his songs. And we were going to do a duet on this show. It was Willie Nelson's 90th birthday, this big thing at Hollywood Bowl. And so Chris was supposed to walk out halfway through the song, and we would, you know, join and finish the song. And his wife, Lisa, said to me, she goes, "Once the song starts, I don't know if I can hold him back." I said, "Just let him, whenever he comes out, it's fine. We'll figure it out." So he came out and we sang the song together. He remembered everything. And not only did he remember all the words, but he remembered the spotlight. And it was incredibly nourishing to him. I could see him soaking up the spotlight and then the love of the audience. He finished the song, we walk off stage, we weren't even out of the wings before he had forgotten it happened.
So is there a performance memory? I see Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett. And it clicks. It could be more than the music, but the consciousness that becomes highlighted when you're performing.
I have a musical memory of sitting on side the stage. I think I just graduated from college, and the Mercer Ellington Orchestra had come to Yale to play with some of the young, and the young students were asked to participate. And it was also, they brought in Ella Fitzgerald to sing with Mercer. Mm-hmm. And I grew up listening to Ella Fitzgerald, and it was like, oh, it was like amazing. And I watched, this was toward the end of her life where she was suffering both from glaucoma and all kinds of, you know, aging difficulties. But I watched what looked like an aged woman sitting by the side of the stage. And there are many stories like this in performers' lives. But I'll never forget the moment that Mercer Ellington called her name to come out and sing. I forgot what song was she even singing. She had a helper who helped her put herself together. And when the spotlight hit, she was Ella. Full of the voice that you all know and everything, and it's muscle memory, it's music memory, it's spotlight memory, it's performer's memory, whatever that is that we take with us as musicians as we grow older. And it's all there. And then, of course, when it was over, she was back to being that kind of an older woman that I saw sitting by the side of the stage. I remembered that moment very well. It was something to remember.
Joe, I'd love to hear you tell folks about contextual memory, whether it's emotional memory or memory, and why what we just heard, those two examples, may be the case in terms of contextual memory.
Yes, I mean, the brain has lots of different circuits that can store memories. So if you're going to remember something, what's called episodic memory, the memories of the things that happen to you in particular over the course of your life, those require a part of the brain called the hippocampus, but also some areas of the cortex that can, the hippocampus and other areas will store those contextual memories. And then when you're in a situation, the episodic memories that will be retrieved in that situation. As part of that, part of an episodic memory is not just, you know, you remember that, but you have to assemble it from three things. What was happening, where it was happening, and when it happened. So you have to have time and place and content. And all of that allows you to have that full experience. Now, there's a different kind of memory, which is related. It's like a lower level called semantic memory, where you know all the facts of those situations, but you don't have the what, where, and when that binds all the facts together. So both of those are important. So you don't want to have to consciously remember everything to get along in life. Sometimes it's good enough just to be able to retrieve those explicit semantic memories. But the semantic memories, when combined in a certain way, give you the whole context, the whole kind of episodic flow. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're talking about, David?
Yeah, that was beautiful. Yeah, thanks.
Could I shift the topic just very slightly? I work a lot on the history of music and film and lots of always looking back. And I'm very interested in the impact of technology on music and memory and these kinds of things. When recordings were first made in the late 19th century, people suddenly could access music as an art for the ear without being present at a performance. And the ear sort of got cut off from the other senses because you could do it just with the ear all alone. And I was wondering what sort of impact that has on the brain as such a science when in the kind of work I do, which is not about science, yeah, but about politics and so on, we know that the impact of technology on the way we play and the way we listen and the way we think about music has completely altered musical practice. But what happens when the ear gets cut off from the eye? We make music into a kind of non-performative art, not for you lot because you make the music, but for most listeners, they're just listening with their ears.
Well, I think it goes back to what Dave is talking about in terms of context. If you don't have the auditory part, it's going to be very different than just having the visual part, right? It's got to all be integrated somehow in the brain.
But if the integration is ruptured and there's a real sort of permanent break because people get brought up listening to music on their iPads, iPads, anything with an I and a P, it must have an impact on the way that they process music and the way they think about it. Because they're not looking at it ever being made. They don't see it. I mean, you know, they do if they watch it, but...
I mean, the beauty of listening to it is it's all there rather than having to be distracted by all the other sounds in the environment. So it's definitely a different way of bringing it in.
Joe, I thought that many kinds of sensory input, whether it's smell, sight, configuration of room, actually solidify the capability to retain memory. Like for example, when my students are trying to memorize something, I have them sit in different configurations in the room. I read somewhere several years ago or something. Mm-hmm. Is this true or?
So there, you know, there are the circuits in the brain that take in stuff. You know, you've got, you know, eyes are going, vision is going into the brain through the visual system, sound through the auditory system, smell, taste, each is going in through a different system, somatosensory touch. All of those are separate. But then there are these things called convergent zones where you might get sights and sounds together, or you might get taste and smell together. And so it all gets integrated, or you might get a convergent zone that has it all, so that it becomes a whole complete experience that reaches your conscious mind and allows you to experience the whole thing without all of the little parts involved. It becomes just a general experience.
And you know, building upon what Joe just said, in addition to the individual modalities like sound, vision, and then the convergence zones where these things come together, there are things called transmodal or heteromodal cortex that not only bring together different modalities like sound and vision or touch, but then even go out of modalities and get to things like concepts or feelings, and connect to the deep limbic areas that Joe has been a pioneer in understanding in terms of the connection between percepts and emotions, for instance. And so people brought up today may be missing some of the multimodal experience, but they still have deep and sometimes, as Joe said, maybe because they're not allocating attention to multiple modalities, it's even more focused, but they still have the connection to emotion and cognition and memory. And of course, you know, music can bring us back to a certain year of high school and immediately like a smell, and place you there very specifically, and can also evoke feelings or certain concepts. So there are these different modalities. They can come together, and then you have areas of the brain that go beyond any given modality and then deal with emotion and thought.
But wouldn't it make a difference if you'd never made music for yourself? You'd never had any kind of performance training, you'd never sung a song. In fact, you probably couldn't sing a song. You'd never played an instrument, and yet you were a listener. You only ever heard it as ready-made. Ready.
Yeah. So there are, and I don't want to cut anyone off. I can't really see or hear as well, but with regard to what you're saying, there's a difference between perceiving music and reacting to it versus playing music, which has to do then with the behavioral systems of the brain and the motivational systems, the premotor systems that plan and organize, and then the motor that organize the movement. And then if you're in a band, or if you're improvising, you know, in jazz or whatever, you have to finally attune yourself in real time and have this closed loop cycle of listening and playing that's very tightly organized and developed and is fascinating as well. So there are different but related systems that have to do with listening to music and appreciating it versus playing it, and then having those two come together. And then finally, for people who are trained musicians or trained in music theory, studies have shown that they process music more in their left hemisphere, more analytically, because they can hear immediately that something is a diminished seventh chord or something, whereas somebody who's a non-musician may just let the music wash over them in a more gestalt way in their right hemisphere, again, an oversimplification, but still with all the feeling and appreciation, but they don't automatically take apart the music theory part.
Well, I think if we're talking about musical improvisation, you're getting to something deeper than just playing, eating, singing. And I wonder how technology influences the context for how our kids can integrate, hear, and improvise.
I have a fun suggestion for everyone. I've been writing a memoir, and one of the things I kind of discovered in the process, obviously I knew that music is a powerful trigger of memories, right? But, and so to do that in real time, what I did was I printed out the Billboard Top 100 list of hits for each year, starting in 1954 when I was 5 years old and first really think about music. And I'd go through each list, and as soon as I would see a song title that grabbed my attention, I would listen to the song. And it's amazing how that just really, each of those songs can take you way back to something so important in your life and allow you to retrieve all those what, where, and how memories and all of that into one big crazy memory. I mean, try it when you get home. It's fun.
Well, I have a question for the scientists. Why is it that I can remember the lyrics for a couple hundred songs easily, but I have no idea what I ate for breakfast yesterday?
I can let Joe answer that, or I can give it a try either. I'm sorry.
You know, this is only slightly relevant to what you're saying, but Greil Marcus, and I'm sure you remember, wrote a lot of things about pop music, Dylan and a lot of other people. But he had this one statement somewhere in one of his writings saying that the music you listen to as an adolescent is the music you will always love the rest of your life. Yeah. Okay, that's kind of a fact. But why is that true? And I did some exploration into this, and I think basically, you know, what's going on when you're a teenager, of course, you got these raging hormones. And everyone assumes that raging hormones are a bad thing. They're like things that are going to get you in trouble. But the fact is, you have these stress hormones and sex hormones. And those kinds of hormones are not just about, they don't make you stressful. They're there to keep you from being less stressed. But sometimes the stress gets so bad that it overflows. And the same thing with sex hormones. They're not just there for sex. For example, estrogen plays a big part in memory in males and females. So as an adolescent, you've got stress, you've got sex, and you've got hormones that are just implanting those memories in a way that will never happen again, because you're never going to have that kind of hormonal upsurge again the rest of your life.
I had no
idea. Well, you also had Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
I think your next song should be like,
yeah, and this is why if you go into a memory care facility, it'll be 1974, you know, because that's the sort of age at which a lot of the residents of the memory care facility came of age, And so you'll be hearing that playlist. And to the point that Joanne, I think, made about improvisation, yes, that is a different thing yet again than just performing. And there have been studies that have shown that actually parts of your prefrontal cortex that are involved in this higher order conscious control actually get shut down and decrease in activity when you're improvising. And then areas in the very front, the rostral right prefrontal cortex, are involved with creativity, and this shifting between these modes, these resting modes of our brain, that come into a certain state, a certain brain state, where you have decreased conscious awareness and effortful control, but you still have facility and actually more flexibility in what you do within certain constraints of the chord progression, for instance, etc.
In musicians' language, I mean, when you're improvising and you're in the zone, the expression that we use is that the instrument disappears. You know, that's what you're describing. Yeah. And the feeling that when your improvisations are the most successful are when you throw it away, when you don't care. Whether through maturity or exhaustion on being on the road or whatever, something takes away the parameters of your brain or mind that, you know, all those bad music teachers that don't do this, do that, whatever it is, all those voices, when those voices start to disappear, some of the best stuff happens.
Okay, you guys are both professional musicians. So as an amateur musician, I find that, you know, when the band is in the groove, as soon as you realize you're in the groove, you lose the groove. You guys probably can keep going, but you, as a non-professional, you get so surprised you're in the groove in the first place that it goes away.
It's an ecstatic feeling, you know.
Yeah. I agree. Letting go, just letting go into the moment. It's beautiful. The best, I don't know if this is related, kind of the best musician, I mean, the best advice I ever got as a musician is to never put myself in the position of being the best musician in the band. He said, there's absolutely no chance of that happening.
Well, your husband will never
that's
be that.
That's why.
Going back to something you said, Lydia, we were talking about how we contextualize a lot of our own biographies, but in your song and whatnot. And I'm wondering if that's the outcome, this connection from hearing and seeing in a concert. So if we contextualize the music we hear as we grow up based on what we're doing, not sitting in a concert hall, listening to what we're doing, maybe that's how we index.
That's how we index these experiences. So I know I could remember almost every, if you name a song from my childhood, I can tell you what year it took place because of that. And I think it's because maybe there was a disconnection between my hearing and actually seeing it in concert.
Yeah, I think there's another element to all this, that pop music was kind of like an advice column for kids, you know, mm-hmm. because you would learn how to deal with breakups and learn how to go after this girl, mm-hmm. that, you know, it was like all of your life could be narrated through those songs, especially, mm-hmm. I remember so many times that, you know, the girl leads me and I'm just brokenhearted. And then there's a song like the Circles song, you're just another starfish in the sea.
But also the mystery, like the songs were that you didn't understand. Those were the songs that were really important to me too, because I had a sense as a teenager, like the whole world is before me, the sense of expansion and longing. And so many of these songs that were probably beyond me intellectually or experience wise, they touched that sense of longing, mm-hmm. and the desire to expand. So hearing those songs, you know, you touch back to that moment when your whole life was ahead of you.
You know, I was watching this.
Now the options are limited.
Detective show a couple of weeks ago, and the first second of the lyrics of this song by Lenny Welch called "Since I Fell for You" is just when you, and he just sings that, when you just give love and get love, but didn't have to get all the way. I heard is when you, and all of a sudden I was in the gym where this girl was, that I thought was dating, was, you know, kissing this other guy. But it's just, it's that moment that it doesn't take much to really take you all the way back.
Yeah.
And there's also this wonderful and powerful aspect. And before we were talking about technology and its effect, one of the effects is to let massive numbers of people hear something at the same time, or a whole stadium full of people hear things at the same time. And the notion of shared experience in the brain and the meaning and meaningfulness of it being within a certain subculture or time and place, and having that be a marker of belonging to a certain in-group, if you will, or crowd, and connecting emotionally with your peers, and or with the emotion, as was just said, you know, that the songwriter and singer are portraying is really important. And we are in society, we're a bunch of brains walking around, you know, organisms interacting with each other. And there are really neat studies now by colleagues of ours that are studying two people listening to this music at the same time, and their brains synchronize, and also ways in which music and can pace the brain and cause certain frequencies and oscillations to occur in time across certain areas. And so we're in an era now of social neuroscience, of how brains interact, and the music convolved with that, and music processing and memory and emotion, and crowd mentality, if you will, for good or for ill, is something that is amenable to study now and is fascinating.
David, did you see the study that showed that when they wired up the musicians and they were rehearsing, that it wasn't just that they sync mentally, something going on when they're playing the music. Their brains were synchronized before the downbeat.
Yeah, no, it is
off.
Just the experience of social music,
something
is bringing people together
before they make a sound.
Yeah,
before they even counted off the beat, they were already synchronized.
Anticipate.
Fascinating.
Wow. I come from such a different context. I mean, in so many respects, because I was brought up in a family of not only classical musicians, but avant-garde composers, students of Schoenberg and so on from Europe. And so I remember hearing Brahms for the first time when I was about five, and that was the first time I'd ever heard tonal music. I mean, so I'm talking a really different context. But I was brought up in a household where the idea that music was connected to emotions and feelings and enjoying it just, that wasn't part of my family. I mean, it was, music was not for emotions or moods. It was really hard graft practice and reading scores. It was pretty bloody awful. But I wrote my first book on the question from my childhood, why do I have to sit still in a concert and be absolutely motionless? Why can't I get up and dance? And I thought, Lydia, stop moving, stop. Lydia, and I was a very wild kid, and I was always being told, shh, shh, shh. So I wrote a book, Why Do I Have to Shut Up in a Concert? And it was only when I was about 16 in London that I first heard popular music, you know, the Beatles and Genesis and Zappa. I used to go to all these concerts. I was pretty wild then, and discovered a whole different kind of audience way in and so on. But when I first started working in the philosophy of music, which was when I was about 20 years old, 1,000 years ago, it feels like now, the question of emotion in music was a complete no-no. It was like, if you weren't serious about music, then you talked about emotions and moods. And if you were serious about music, you talked about anything except emotions. And that really dominated my discipline for the last 40 or 50 years. And even when cognitive philosophers and psychologists working on music and emotions, they have a very sort of set way of speaking about emotions, not complex moods, but I feel happy, I feel sad, as if anybody ever feels happy or sad. With, I mean, it seems a bit simplistic. I'm more of a Freudian. I don't feel it in this. And so my question is, what does the what kind of experience do we have with music that is not about emotions? And you said how to put your notes together and so on. We've talked about memory, but we've got memory, we've got emotions. Is there anything else? Is there any kind of conceptual or
any kind of
knowledge that comes with it? I mean, I work in music and politics, so this is really a key question for me, but I'll...
So I have two things to say. One is that every experience is a combination of emotion and memory.
That's it?
That's big.
That's it?
That's not it, but that is a fact. Mm-hmm. And what was the other thing? I forget.
forgot the memory.
Right. And what you're talking about, Lydia, is this intellectualization and these other excuse me,
that puts it down if you say it's intellectual.
I meant that in the best sense of the word, that essentially in addition to any emotional aspects or not, there is a deep taking apart of the structure and microstructure and the concepts behind and the meaning behind the composition and or the performance, etc. And so, just as was said, there's different kinds of music, there's different contexts, there's different mores or rules of in times and places of listening to things. There are cultural aspects too. I have a friend, we played in a band together in high school, underage in jazz clubs in New York City. And he went on to be a professional musician. He's a keyboard player, but he's also a master African drummer, West African drummer. And in Western music, you know, it is very complex, potentially, not pop music, but melodically and harmonically. But a lot of times it's in 4-4 or 3-4, and it's pretty simple rhythmically, whereas it's the opposite in the Western, in the West African drumming, where there's not as much melodic, although each instrument or bell or drum has its voice, but it's incredibly polyrhythmic with all sorts of weird, we would think weird, but natural time signatures, very complex, interacting. And then, of course, a lot of movement and dance that goes along with that. And so in different cultures, there's and it's very elemental and very felt and so forth. So there are all these different aspects, whether it's intellectual, whether it's rhythm, whether it's melody, harmony, each of which can be dissociated, but they can also come together in different ways or separate in different ways in different contexts.
I remembered what I forgot. What year was that when you said that you couldn't like talk about emotion and music together? Roughly.
Sorry, when did that start?
What time was that in what year?
In my life?
Yeah.
Oh, I was about 3 years. I mean, so when I started it? Yes. Sorry.
Yes. When you were told not to combine emotion and music?
No, I mean, that was my entire upbringing, but it was I first started working on the philosophy of music.
Okay. Because the reason I asked is because when I started in neuroscience in the 1970s and tried to get research to study emotion in the brain, mm-hmm. the review was neuroscientists do not study emotion, reject. Right. So it was the same thing, but a little later, and also in science.
One of the things we've been doing at the Louis Armstrong Center, influenced by your work with the amygdala, is looking at the effect of music in depression. We have really devoted time and energy to assessing the music experiences that can navigate depression. Because depression crosses so many different disease trajectories. And when we take the culture and we take the teenagers and we take children and we take the older adults who are mild cognitively impaired, we see succinct experiences that can help them deal with the depression in music.
Yeah. Joanne, if I may, again, I don't want to cut off anybody else if someone's going to say something. So please, you know, I can lay back, but I do have something to comment upon there, what you're saying.
Go for it.
Studies have shown that music can activate a region called the ventral striatum or nucleus accumbens, which is a key reward or motivational or reinforcement learning system or core node of a system, an activating system in the brain. And a big symptom of depression, as you know, is anhedonia, which is lack of interest or pleasure in usual activities. And so the notion that music can be a neuromodulator, which is something that we're exploring, is absolutely the case, and it can be therapeutic. The best prescription I ever wrote as a physician was one day when I was in the office at the Brigham, and I got a call from one of the senior administrators at the Brigham, and she said, David, who I knew, and she said, David, can you help me with my niece? She's terribly depressed. And I said, of course. And she gave me her phone number and said that she'd be willing to speak to me. So I called her niece, who was a high school student in a town nearby outside of Boston. And the first thing I did, obviously, always is make sure she's safe and she's not suicidal. There's nothing that needed to be done acutely. But also then I needed to figure out, was she depressed or not? What's going on diagnostically, and who to refer to in my department? And I always like to ask a person's strengths and interests as well as symptoms and so forth. So we go through talking, and it turns out that she used to love music, although not anymore. And she's been mostly in her room and crying and on and on. So in addition to sort of setting her up in our department, while I was on the phone with her, I was Googling, looking at the screen, and to see what concerts were playing that night in Boston. And it turns out that Dave Matthews Band was playing nearby. And so, which was a kind of music that I guess from what she said that she would really enjoy it when, if she were feeling well. So I get off the phone with her and we arrange the follow-up clinically. And I'm sorry to go on, I'm almost done with the story. But, and then I called her aunt back and I said, get her two tickets to Dave Matthews tonight and surprise her. And so she did. And so it was out of the blue. She had no time to think about it. It was a gift from her aunt. It was a surprise, and it was two tickets. And she went with her sister to the Dave Matthews concert that night. And to this day, I hear from the family that was the turning point for her in her depression. Before the first antidepressant passed her lips or any psychotherapy, going to that concert that night, having no choice but to go to that, which she otherwise wouldn't have done, was a turning point. So I'm sorry to spend a little time on the story.
In Europe, it's widely known that's called a social prescription.
Mm-hmm.
In the US, we're just catching up.
What does the field, Joanne, think about the experience of whether a musician or non-musician, you experience and listen to music and it elevates you? And you're in this big, you know, wonderful ecstatic place. And then when the music is over, and for many professionals I know, it's a place of where people plunge when it's not happening.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a bit?
We are trying to develop ways to figure out what happens in the brain so that we can take the excitement of the music.
And make it last.
And make it last.
I have a question that's the opposite, which is that I know not many, but I do know professional musicians who've been doing it a really long time who don't want to hear or play music anymore. They can't stand it anymore. I mean, I know a truly great musician who actually said, I hate music. I don't want to do it anymore. What happens to those people?
I would say they need music therapy because a good evaluation will lead us to exactly the context and situation of what made them hate it. There are triggers, especially for music.
Triggers that lead to
being done.
Yeah.
Is it the music or is it the music business that...
Well, there's that. Yeah.
Or having done it with too much concentration for too long, wanting to make a change in one's life.
I don't know. I mean, I would have to separate out the business of your performer, the exhaustion from traveling, all of that separate from the music. I'm talking about the very few musicians I know who actually say, I can't stand it anymore. I don't want to hear music.
Well, it's fascinating.
The performer has a false self. Every night you go on your music performance, you get it's a false sense of self.
Well, okay, I'm still going one step further. He stopped performing, stopped playing himself. He doesn't want to listen to anyone else's music either.
Wow. True.
He just wants silence, just a break.
Well, this goes back a little bit to what David was mentioning about this term anhedonia.
Yeah.
Where anhedonia isn't just simply a lack of response to positive experiences, but sometimes it's almost like the polarity changes. You actually reject something that normally would be pleasant to you. And it doesn't mean you can't try to override it and correct it, but that is part of what anhedonia is like. It's like reverse polarity.
I just wrote a piece, an essay on noise in a particular philosopher who couldn't stand noise. And it turns out that many philosophers can't bear noise. So not only, I'm like that, I would never listen to music while I'm writing. I can't stand music as background. If I've got music on, I want to listen to it. So this idea that you have, when it becomes a kind of background interference in some other brain process, it might cause a lot of anxiety.
Well, many musicians can't listen to music as background.
Yeah, very few do. Yeah, right, yeah.
Thousands are the music.
That's right. The space between the notes.
Does your music ever get into your politics or vice versa?
Most of the time. All of it. Yeah.
What would be an example?
Oh, I feel so depressed today. I'm part of Columbia University, but we're not going to go there.
No,
God. No, I've written about the use of music in concentration camps and that kind of stuff. I really deal with shitty
anything
themes.
In the current mode.
So we're not going to go to anywhere near that. But I had another question, which is for you wonderful scientists of music and scientists of the mind, is the philosopher Nietzsche pointed out that he could go and see Aida, the opera by Verdi, 20 times. And every time it would be as though he were hearing it for the first time. And when we listen to popular music, we can not only sing it from the first note, if we know the way that the tune goes, and then fans can listen to a popular song and know every word, they can listen to it 1,000 times and it never become boring. And moreover, it doesn't not only not become boring, they are moved by it in the same way. So if you go and see Puccini's La Bohème, you know Mimi's going to die at the end, and there'll be these great Mimi chords at the end, and still you're burst into tears as though you didn't know she was going to die. And that's a really, so I want an account now of how music, the emotion works in repetition. Please.
I have a personal response to that.
Good.
Which is that there are some songs of mine that I've now been singing for 45 years and develop a relationship with the song. So in the early years, you know, I'm just all a flush with a glow with how much I love the song and so great, so excited to sing it. And then, you know, about year 15 to 30, I go, I really don't want to sing this song anymore. And then it's now like a song my daughter wrote. There's a certain sweetness to it. And now getting to the, towards the end of what I would think is the end of my touring life in the next few years, I think often while I'm singing it, this could be the last time that the person who wrote this song sings this song. Yeah. And there's something really moving about that. So I it helps me be present with that song in that moment. So it changes over time. Like you said, every time you hear, you know she's going to die at the end, but still.
You know, they say that about children, that they'll watch this, listen to the same song or TV show or something, and they just want to hear it over and over and over again. And Ed, you got to chime in here. In childhood development, why is it that the child keeps listening and listening to the same thing over and loves it? Can't get enough of it.
It's the same with Alzheimer's patients. They get
stimulated by it and they just want to keep getting stimulated. That's all I know.
Yeah, and in autism.
In between, by Alzheimer's patients, they can watch the same film over and over again, two or three times a day, and that was the first time they were seeing it, which is...
Yeah, and we see the same thing in autism as well, where someone with autism very frequently will want to... and get great joy from and react as if it's the first time, so to speak, from or in the context of the same movie or the same song, etc. So this sort of repetition, the joy in repetition or sometimes a repetition compulsion is fascinating. The you know, a lot of what you all have been talking about in the past few minutes, which is really terrific, it has to do with, and I love this notion of relationship to the music that you were speaking about, Roseanne, and how that changes with time, because it really is the case. And you know, Joe is an expert in this. There's memories also can be similar over time, and or they can change. And we used to think that every time you pull up a memory, it's the same, but it turns out that they're very labile when you pull them up. And this is something that with Joe's leadership, the field is trying to address in terms of, you know, treating PTSD to try to strip the negative emotion away from the episodic memory. But when you pull up each time or when you re-experience each time something, it is the same and it's not the same. And those two can interact in very, very interesting ways. May I say in terms of what we were talking about before of not being able to listen to music that you were saying, Roseanne, there's also issues of stress and burnout and PTSD that, you know, in terms of one's career and so forth. I mean, for many years, I was in New York City for many years at Cornell Medical Center, New York Presbyterian Hospital, and did all my, you know, both residencies there and spent countless nights on call, you know, before the laws changed to cut the hours that people had to do for training. And there was a period of time where if I went back into that hospital, I had almost an aversion and a PTSD, an aversive response, which again, Joe is an expert in. So there are all these things. And then finally, on the positive side, as was talked about before then, the opiate system and dopaminergic system is involved. And the relation between that and addiction and withdrawal is not just metaphorical. And so these are a lot of fascinating crossover issues with brain and music.
I have one, just a fourth or fifth or sixth notion of repetition to add to your list. And that is after 40 years not playing, I took the violin up again. So I'm now playing every day again, as I did when I was very young. And so I'm very conscious of how I practice every day. But I take a particular piece. At the moment, it's a Brahms sonata. And I work on it every single day, and I work on it in the same way every day. But every day there are incremental differences, and that's called improvement, I hope. In my case, it's very slow. But we practice and we practice. And what amazes me is that, say, last week I couldn't do that. And then I wake up one morning and I can, and my fingers have suddenly can move in the right pattern to get it. And from one day to the next, it can completely change. And that's another structuring of our repetitive memory work that works with the fingers and the hands. And you do that in songwriting to make your voice, my partner is with his voice, ever better, ever smoother, ever this, ever that. But these differences are incremental. So there is repetition, but these beautifully minute differences that occur each day that keep you going. And I think that's another
thing. I find that, I've played guitar since I was 13 years old, and I haven't probably gotten any better, but I still play. But that as I age, my hands aren't the same, right?
Because
part of that day-to-day is that your hands are not as good as they used to be.
Joe, could you talk about memory consolidation, including during sleep? And that might also explain some of what we've just heard.
I don't know about sleep. I mean, that's not really a topic I've explored, but I can just briefly say what you were talking about in terms of memories being labile and changed every time you use them. A researcher in my lab this had been around for a long time, but this guy, Kareem Nader, who's a brilliant postdoc, actually turned what we used to call consolidation as the, you learn it, you store it, and every time you remember the same thing. And he came up with a way that showed that in the brain, you learn, you store, and every time you take it out, it's different.
Yeah.
And there's a good aspect to that, right? Because over time, you things do change, and you add new information to what you know. But on the other hand, there's a negative aspect because someone giving testimony in a trial will not necessarily give the information they saw on the day of the crime, but what they read in the paper or saw online or something else, or what they imagined or rethought and just kind of scrambled it up. So, I mean, the whole judicial system is based on a very, very flimsy idea. I hope I'm never convicted of a crime.
What about music and movement?
So a couple of things. One, just to add to what Joe was saying, that in sleep, someone named Bob Stickgold and others have done beautiful experiments to show that memories are sort of solidified during sleep. And that's why when you sleep on it, so to speak, or if you're working on a song, Roseanne, and you're trying to compose it, and then you wake up and all of a sudden it just pops in your head in a different way. Or as you were saying, Lydia, if you practice and then the next day it's there and then some. So the brain is very active during sleep and can be involved in consolidation of those sorts of things. The question you just asked, I'm sorry.
Dreaming plays a role, though.
Oh, dreaming, absolutely, as well. But before that, you asked a question. The motor. So what we see is that that premotor areas get activated in the brain with music. So it doesn't just, the notion that music gets you moving is not just a metaphor. And in fact, maybe part of evolutionarily why we have music, or out of the context out of which music and rhythm and movement and communal things and remembering things societally in an oral tradition before there was the written word, you know, developed. And so the music and movement is linked in the brain, and it's not just a perceptual thing. Your perceptual system is tightly linked in a loop to your motor system. And so that's something that's notable.
People move with music without really thinking about it.
There's a lot of writing, I think, comes out of France on embodied music. So embodied mind, not just this mind studies, but actually being embodied. And I remember once going to a concert of an African singing and drumming, and the lecture was given on the music and about the, you know, all its complex harmonic structures and its rhythm and so on. But the one thing that was not commented on at all, which seemed absolutely obvious, was that all the rhythm was going on in the feet. And it was the most elaborate footwork I've ever seen in any way past ballet or dance. It was incredible. So I asked about this, and the lecturer looked down at the feet of these Africans, said, "Oh, I never looked that far down." And it was incredible. All it was unbelievable. What like their toes were like on a piano keys. It was incredible. So, I think that when we talk about music and mind, we always have to talk about the body, which we tend to forget a lot. Certainly in my field, very few people ever talk about the body. It's a sort of no-no, you know, not serious part. But you're philosophers, yeah. You know, what can I say? This sort of embodied work that goes on in practice. Mm-hmm. That's why I was talking about the formative aspect, the making of music being so different from the reception of music, where mm-hmm. we don't describe that as an embodied experience unless you're dancing to it. I mean, but in a concert hall, they say it's disembodied listening, which is really bizarre. It's a really weird thing.
Yeah. Well, most classical musicians are getting away with that old notion of standing like a sphinx when you play it. That's starting to change in my world and in my own performance experience.
An orchestra, movement.
Yeah, you'll see people being much more expressive physically today.
It's usually terrible, but the orchestra the orchestra musicians are really bad.
Conductors have been doing it for a long time.
I know. Orchestra musicians are really bad dancers, in my experience. You'd get them onto a disco floor. They have no rhythm at all. They're brilliant.
in my world, in the jazz field, movement and dance and the music having come from the blues.
Yeah.
Feeling in the body is just as natural as can be, and yet the instrumental tradition has tried to teach young musicians, must be still, you must not move. Yeah. And I always moved a lot when I played, and it wasn't until I got much, much older that I learned from working with dancers and choreographers, it's an interesting thing, and just go with it, you know, why not?
When I started learning the violin again, my partner, my opera singer, said to me, "Lydia, I really don't want to hear you emoting or your body expressing." He said, "I want to hear your instrument doing it. Can you make your instrument sing?"
As if your body was against
on the contrary. He said so many violinists move, but it doesn't get put into the instrument. He said, if you think about the body as a breathing instrument, then that's what he said. That's what I want to hear in your violin. I want to hear it breathing and the music.
I know what just what you mean. They say that about, I'm into professional figure skating. Yeah. They say, I want to see it in your skates. I want to see it in the blade.
Right.
They do all these things with their hands, but it's not related to what's coming up for the entire body.
He told me just to do the Caruso sort of raising of the chest to breathe. He said it would go into my violin in a way that was completely. And so it's completely embodied, but the violin becomes the body, the extension
part
of the body.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was
David
a good lesson.
David wants to add something.
I think Joanne would know that, in Parkinson's disease, people can't move. They're literally frozen and they have something called shuffling gait, where they lean over and they have trouble starting to move. And these are difficulties in areas of the brain called the substantia nigra and the basal ganglia, et cetera, and dopamine and motor systems. And it turns out that a patient with Parkinson's, if you play a march, they will actually be able to start moving, because their embodied movement and another pathway through this basal ganglia and motor system gets activated. And so someone who's literally frozen, it seems, quote, miraculous. You play something with a pace and a march, and they'll start to move and they'll start to walk in time with the march and be able to initiate activity and get over that hump, which they, because of inhibition, they in their nervous system, they couldn't do before.
Is it rhythm, Joanne, that
Our
does it? Is
brains
it
are
rhythm?
pre-wired to entrain with music, no matter what our disability. So it seems fascinating, but quite common that people will move to a beat.
A beat.
Rhythm is primary.
And you see this in babies as well. If you play music to babies, they'll sway, and to animals, sometimes they will move in concert with the music.
Okay.
Right. Well, I think that was absolutely wonderful. I wonder if people from the audience, anyone from the audience, want to come up and ask a question of our panel.
Thank you all so very much. This is really, really engrossing. Joanne, you mentioned entrainment based in rhythm, which I will be referencing at the next session with mindfulness meditation. So thank you for that. But I also wanted to ask the panel about the pro-social behavior that's cultivated through music. So the Max Planck Institute, the study of the five-year-olds, one group was played a song and they sang together, and the other group that did not have a music as a cohesive sort of exercise before they then went about a task of, I think, building a little Lego village or something comparable. And it turned out, of course, that the group that had and sang music together were much more accomplished at coordinating and collaborating in the task that they had in front of them. So I was wondering whether we could explore that a little bit. It's been touched on, but it'd be great to hear some more opinions. Thank you so much.
I think of horrible political consequence of your question. Those really musical nations who coordinate way too well, right? I'm not going there. I'm too depressed. But we'll have a nicer answer. But those really musical cultures that march in time. Yeah, it's not always good in bringing people together. We'd rather they be kept apart sometimes.
It has been shown that music increases oxytocin, which is a pro-social, sort of bonding hormone in the brain. In that experiment or study that you described, one would wonder whether there was a control condition where they were doing a non-musical collective activity, and if the music was any more effective than the non-musical collective activity in priming the social cohesion and cooperation, et cetera. But certainly it can.
Tim, I would say too that we're in incredibly divisive times, and that music is one place we create community. I mean, I feel that in performance and concert too, that you created a community in 2 hours, and that can ripple out into the rest of your life and into the world.
So Roseanne and I are friends with Dan Levitin, who's written some great books on music in the brain. He has a new one out. I advise you to check that out. Have you read it?
I haven't read it yet.
I have it, but I haven't read it.
I did. I did.
You have read it?
Yeah. It's interesting.
Any other questions?
Oh, there's someone back here.
Thank you. That was wonderful. My mom was a psych nurse, so we had a lot of darkness visible around my house, the William Styron book, and he talked about music helping him through depression, specifically a piece of classical music, but that's not why I'm here. My father was a folk singer in the Pete Seeger tradition, and he often led groups in song in rounds during the 60s and 70s in Buffalo, where the Vietnam War was a particularly big issue because of our proximity to Canada. Mm. And I felt, as you just said, there was a lot of ripple effect from these hoot nannies, such as they were at the time, the excitement of people singing together. And I'm wondering if that's not a thing anymore, or I'm just too old to be part of it. Is that no longer really part of what happens in these divisive times and activist times? Thank you.
It's a thing. And we need to make it happen as the music commune. That's my...
There's a reason why music is so prevalent in religious settings as well, which is not dissimilar.
You know, with my experience with college-age students, I'm a professor at the New School, and I teach improvisation, and I'm around a lot of young people who went through the pandemic, who live a life, you know, on an iPhone and stuff. Mm. And I have to say, when we demand of them, you know, an in-person, an ensemble experience, whatever it is, instrumental or dance, music, where they're just, you know, phones down, relating to each other. There's a kind of surprise. You'd be you wouldn't think that it would be surprising for young people to, they're having a great time, you know, relating to one another as a band or as an ensemble, as a dance group, and they actually it's almost like this fresh new. It's like showing them something fresh and new, which everybody knows shouldn't be, but for a particular generation, it is, and it's tremendously important. And yet you can feel the response from them. They're like ecstatic. Wow, we got to have more of this. Mm-hmm. And that's like what you do in a concert. You're creating an environment in 2 hours. People get really high on the experience and they want more of it, you know. It's experiential. It's visceral. You know, that's our contribution, I guess.
And in the reverse case, I recently saw two groups competing in political protest, competing over how loud they could scream their slogans in chant to out-scream each other. And it produced more divisiveness than we've ever seen before. Mm. Yet I love the idea that people would come together in 2 hours as a community through song. Yeah. But at the moment, we're seeing the use of chanting and shouting and screaming to create something I don't think we've seen, most of us, in our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least in this country.
Yeah. May I say something? We've been talking about music and social. There's also music, and we talked about technology before. There's this solipsistic aspect as well. Which can also be addicting in a sort of way. I remember the first time listening to Pandora, where you give it thumbs up or thumbs down for given tune, and then it zeroes in on what you like. It's almost like an electrode right into your nucleus accumbens, your reinforcement reward system. And for me, that was Chicago blues, electric guitar blues, or Texas blues. And so, but it was striking how much and how quickly it had zeroed in. And people have their playlists now, and particularly the younger generation, and they're in their world with their ear pods and so forth. And now we have AI, which we haven't talked about, potentially being able to, you know, quote, compose songs, and or, you know, feed you things based upon algorithms in ways that, again, can be dystopian as well as beneficial. So I think these are things we're going to have to think a lot about going forward.
I have a question for Roseanne. I remember seeing videotapes of the tours that Taylor Swift, her most recent tours, and in which it seemed that everyone in the audience was singing along with her. And I looked at that and I was horrified because I wanted to hear, if I had been there, I thought, well, I wanted to hear her. Can you tell me, as a musician performer like that, how you react to the idea that everyone in the audience would be singing along?
Well, I'm not Taylor Swift, so I don't. I can't imagine that happening with as many people as it happened with Taylor Swift, but yeah. I think towards the end of a show, if I'm just thinking about it, when people start singing a well-known song with you, you know, at the end of the show, it's really fun. But if they're singing something, you're trying to deliver something important, you're really inside it, and they start singing along, that would be disconcerting. I've only ever had that happen, like I said, at the end when, you know, it's a song everybody knows and it's closing out the night. Sorry?
It becomes energizing.
Yeah, it's energizing, right. But through the whole set, that would be discouraging.
With one of my sons, do you consider hip hop music?
Yeah.
No, hot tub.
Yeah, I do too.
As opposed to what?
No music.
I'm sorry?
I said, as opposed to no music. They think it's music.
It is music.
As opposed to what? I said, to no music.
There isn't anything called non-music. Non-music is music.
Yeah, I don't think you can define what someone else considers music, you know?
Well, that's music to my ears. And your laughter, too. Anyway, I want to thank everyone here for an absolutely wonderful.